So my name is Ben Hammond, and I'm going to start by telling you a story. Quite a few years ago now, it was Valentine's Day. And I'm going to take my wife, who's sitting right here, and next to my oldest son, I'm going to take her out for Valentine's Day. And so we go out for Valentine's Day, and you got to understand something about me. I am a, I have fine taste in food, okay? So we're going to get together. We're going to go out to eat for Valentine's Day. And so we get all dressed up and we go to one of our favorite restaurants, the Chinese buffet. Okay? The Chinese buffet and me are at one. So we're going to go to the Chinese buffet. And how many of you like Chinese buffet?
We do.
Okay, how many like buffet? I tell people, my favorite restaurant, buffet. I don't care what's before or after it, buffet is my favorite. So anyway, we go out there. And just like always, every time we go, you walk in and it just looks so good, right? And you're tasting this all day and you go in and you can't even decide what to eat because there's just, you know, there's food everywhere. So you take the first plate and you mound it up and the second and the third and, you know, trying to keep up with your wife, you know how that goes. And about 30 minutes into this, what happens? I never want to see food again. You've been there, right? It's like this thing that looks so good to you half an hour ago or 45 minutes ago or 2 hours, whatever you do. All of a sudden doesn't look so good anymore, okay? And you're like, I don't even want to go back in there again. I don't ever want to see food again. I want nothing to do with that again. Now, think about that and think, do you ever feel like that on Sunday when you leave church? I mean, don't raise your hand or, you know, you're not supposed to admit this stuff, okay? This is just between you and God, I guess. But do you ever feel like that with the ministry? Any of you pastors? Any of you pastors in here? Okay. Pastors' wives? Ministry full-time? Any of you work in your church at all? Awesome. Good. See, the pastors aren't in here today because they say, I want to quit and I don't want to get convicted, so I'm not going to that one. Right? So you guys may be working with kids, working with, you know, adults, teaching a class, whatever you're doing. Do you ever feel like, what did I ever do when I volunteered for this?
Yes.
Okay, thank you for being honest. You know, sometimes, it's not like you don't like it. It's not like you're saying, you know, I really wish I never would have done it. But you walk out of there someday and you're like, you know, I wish I'd never heard the words of Juana, the letters of Juana. I wish, you know, they had never come to me and asked me. Sometimes you just feel like that. Now, deep inside, you know, when I leave the buffet, I know I'm going to want to come back one day. But not now, okay? I'm tired of it for now. So you feel like that sometime, even in your ministry work. And so it just happens to everybody. It can happen when you're eating, can happen in the church, can happen all the time. Some days, we don't have many in full-time ministry here, but let me just give you some insider secrets. If you're in full-time ministry, some days you think, clocking in and out sounds really good. You know, maybe it's worse for all of you who don't get paid for what you do. You know, at least if I could get paid for the trouble I have to face. And so you feel like, man, I don't know. So we're going to ask this question here. This goes if you're in a full-time ministry, as in paid vocational, or if you're showing up on Sunday school, teaching, or working in a WAN, or working in some kind of kids club, whatever it is you guys do, okay? Do you ever feel, or do you always feel like showing up? I mean, every time, all the time, you're walking in there, and as soon as it's over, you're like, I can't wait to come back next week. Anybody like, okay. Nah, not always. There's a few times you're like, I want to disappear, okay. Do you always feel like showing up? Some of you say, of course, and the honest ones say, I really supposed to say yes, but man, I'm not so sure about this. All right, so everyone's in this boat from time to time, but we can even take it a little deeper and say, do you always feel like serving God at all? Do you always feel like worshiping God? I mean, do you get up every morning and say, man, it is so awesome that I'm alive? I mean, every single morning. And some of you nodding, you guys should be teaching this. You're awesome. Most people, like, there's some days, man, I might crawl under a rock. You know, sometimes you're like, it's not that I don't love God enough. It's not that, but it's just like today, man, I just don't feel like it. Sometimes feelings get in the way. Yeah, if they're a rock to crawl under. So sometimes it's easy, okay? You know, you go into church and you're doing your job, whatever it is you happen to be doing. And everybody's supportive of you, right? You walk by and they slap you on the back. Hey, you do such a good job. Man, I saw the way you're working with the kids last week and you did a great job. And people complimenting you on what you do. You show up and the audio visual's working correctly. That's kind of a rare thing. Okay. You show up, everything works well. you know, your church has money, your program, whatever it is you're doing, have money, and it's great. But then sometimes you show up and it's like everybody hates you. How many of you are working with kids in your church? Kids. How many of the kids hate you from time to time in your, no, okay, we do have some, right? And it's probably your own kids that are coming with you, right? But sometimes you show up and it's like the kids don't want to listen, adults don't want to listen. If you're a pastor, you know that you think the church is going to vote you out and you almost wish they would, that kind of a thing. You've been there, right? So, you get to church and you realize you forgot your Bible, forgot your notes, forgot your youngest child, all kinds of things. But it's just, that doesn't go right from time to time. So we have these difficulties here. Most people have been there at some point, and if you haven't, you might be. At some point, you might get to the place where you're going to say, you know, I'm just kind of tired of this. Then you go to a workshop like this, and the title is, give me one reason, one good reason not to quit. Okay? So there it is. Give me one good reason not to quit. So that's what I'm going to do today. That's the promise, okay? I'm going to give you one good reason, but it's going to have... you know, it's going to be kind of multifaceted. Here's one. If someone were to ask me this, well, give me one good reason not to quit. I have found, being a pastor, that if I'm going to answer questions in my own life, I should think about how I would give advice to someone else. Because you may have noticed that it's so much easier to give advice to other people than it is to do it yourself. Okay, so what would I tell someone else if they came to me and say, you know, I'm tired, I just want to quit. What answer would I give to them? You know, if you came to me and said, I just want to quit, I might say, but those kids need you. That choir needs you if you're leading a choir. Or somebody needs you. I might say something like that. Or I could say, you're good at it. Don't waste your talents. Or I might say, hang in there, it'll make you stronger. Don't you love that one? Or the clincher is, God called you to do it, so keep it up. I mean, you know, that's going to answer the question, right? I know God called me to do it, but that doesn't mean I feel like it. You don't have to always feel like something that's right. You do things that you don't feel like doing from time to time. So you say, okay, you gave me a lot of good reasons there, but I still don't care. I'm still looking for my one good reason why I should do the thing that I do. Why I should continue in my ministry or why I should continue serving God. So let me ask you this question. Do you ever feel or do you ever do anything that you don't feel like doing?
Sure.
Like what?
Laundry.
Laundry. Hey, there you go. What else do you do that you don't feel like doing?
Changing diapers.
Changing diapers.
Cleaning up after your children's mess.
Cleaning up after your children's mess. Yeah. How many of you enjoy going to the doctor? It's so fun to go to the doctor because not only will they charge you, but they'll tell you something's wrong with you and you have to come back, right? So you don't like to do that. You change the oil in your car, or at least you take it somewhere to get it changed. You eat salad instead of a donut, right? Tomorrow night, you guys have been here to the banquet, some of you. If you haven't, tomorrow night's the big banquet, and they'll line up the whole wall with all these desserts, and the little Holy Spirit voice inside you will say, you shouldn't eat that stuff. Then you say, but Quentin Road provides it, so I don't want them to feel bad, you know, that kind of thing. But sometimes you say, but you know, I'm gaining a little weight, I'm going to not eat that even though that's what I want to do, and I'll have something else. So sometimes we do things that we don't want to do. And the question is, why do we do that? Why do we have the salad instead of the donut? Why do we do laundry when we really don't want to? Why do we change the diaper? Well, that was kind of obvious. But why do we do things when we don't want to do it? And here's the answer. We do things that we don't feel like doing because something is more important than our feelings. Okay, you understand? I don't feel like doing laundry, but there's something more important than what I feel like today, and that is my kids are not going to have anything to wear if I don't do laundry. Yes. Yes, they're right back on that table in the corner. I can't stray too far from here because I'm chained to this thing, but they are right back there. I like handouts because then I walk around at the end, and if they're not all filled out, I know who fell asleep on me, so we're all good, okay? And if you turn them in at the end, I won't give you anything for it. Another Snickers, maybe. Yeah, I have another Snickers. I got more, yeah. So some things are more important than our feelings, okay? So what we want to figure out as we look at the whole idea of worshiping God or serving God or staying involved in our ministry is we're looking for that answer. Why do I continue this even though I might not feel like it from time to time? What is that thing that makes that is more important than how I feel? Because, you know, some of you say, I always feel like it, and some of you say, well, I don't always feel like it. So what's going to keep me in it? Quite a few years ago, I had a guy call me that I had known years ago, and when I first went into the ministry, and he said, I'm having some troubles in my church. He's a pastor now, and he says, I have this opportunity that has come up, and it's a camp that's not too far from us that is looking for a director. And as soon as he said that, I knew exactly where he was going, because there have been times in my ministry as a pastor, I have thought, I would like to run a camp, because I don't have a congregation when I have a camp. The problem is, then you're dealing with pastors, and I don't know if that's any better, right? But, you know, I thought, just, there have been times in my life, I thought, something like that. So I knew exactly what he was thinking. He's thinking, this is at least a change for me. It's something different I can do, because I've got all this hassle. And he ended up staying in his church where he was. But that happens from time to time. If it's you working in your kids' ministry or whatever, sometimes you think, you know, just some time off. And I just got to get away from this. I got to do something else. Give me one good reason why I should keep going. Okay, now is the time I'm going to tell you the one answer. And as soon as I give you this answer, don't say, oh, that's so simple, I should have gone to another workshop. Because we're going to discuss why this is the answer. Okay, it sounds too simple. But here it is. The one good reason not to quit is who God is. Who God is. It's nothing to do with your feelings. It's not, you need to keep going because one day you're going to feel like it again, or because you plow through and one day you'll be successful. The one reason to keep going when you don't feel like it is because of who God is, his character. Now notice, I didn't say that I'm going to give you one good reason to feel like not quitting. You see the difference there? I can't do anything about your feelings. I can't do anything about my feelings necessarily. But we can look at the underlying reason and say we can plow through something because there's something that's more important than how I feel. I don't feel like getting up on Sunday and going to do my ministry, but we don't get up and go do our ministry on Sunday because we feel like it. We get up on Sunday and we do our ministry, or Wednesday, or whenever you do your thing, because of who God is, not what God has done for you. You know, God saved me, God's done all this, so I'm returning it. No, it's just basically his character, who he is. So you say, oh, really? I came for that? You know, I already knew that. I already knew who God was. I mean, I read my Bible, right? So we're going to talk about this a little bit today. How do we know who God is? It's one of the, well, you read your Bible, obviously, but one of the best ways in the Bible, I think, that we can understand who God is through his names. And so that's kind of what we're going to go here today, and talk about. We learn about God, who God is through his names. Now, names are important. How many of you have children? How many of you went through the struggle of naming your children? My wife is the hardest one. Not really. It was my fault. So we have four kids, okay? This is my oldest son, Austin. Austin James. The reason it's Austin James is because I am Benjamin James. So he took my middle name. When our daughter came along, Chloe Nicole, because her middle name is Nicole, Lori Nicole. And so, you know, those were easy, but the rest of it was a little difficult. So she'd come up to me, man, I got this wonderful name. And no, that reminds me of this kid in second grade that had a runny nose all the time. Can't name him that, right? Well, that reminds me of, oh, you know, that person, or this one particular name, I won't mention a name. You know, I'm not going to name my daughter that because it reminds me of the girl that my mom thought I should have married in high school. I know this is being recorded, but she looked like an ape. Her knuckles dragged on the ground. That's the way I looked at it. I'm not naming my daughter that name. Okay, so it was really hard for us to come up with a name because, I mean, this kid's going to be stuck with this name his or her whole life. Right? You're going to be stuck with this name. And so it's very important. And we thought about the meanings of the name. My name, Benjamin, means son of the right hand. And so my parents put some thought into that, and we put thought into our kids' names. But when we come to the Bible and we look at the names that God gave to himself or that other people attributed to God, it tells us something about who God is. And we're just going to look at four of these today. And just to get an idea, and by the way, if you're interested in this, this is a commercial short break. I wrote a book on this subject. It's called Miserable But Motivated, How the Names of God Motivate Worship in Miserable Circumstance. So I go through lots of the names of God of God on an altar or two and even a city or two that describes something about God. So it's on my table. It's here if you're interested in it. But we're going to talk about a few of the names. God revealed his names to tell us something about himself that affects how we live. And think about this. When you're looking in the Bible, God could have very easily come to people and said, this is what I want you to do, now go do it. But oftentimes what he did was he would tell them, this is what I want you to do, or I know you're in trouble and I'm going to help. And instead of just saying that, he would reveal a new name of himself. And as he revealed this new name of himself, he was telling those people something about himself that would encourage them to go on and do whatever they were supposed to do. And that's why his names are so important. So you don't go out of this workshop today saying, when I walked in, I felt like quitting. Now I don't feel like it. Like they did some hocus pocus on me and I'm all good. No, but you come out of here, I hope, with an understanding of why you do what you do. And that should, in time, change the feelings when things are a little bit difficult. So we're just going to look at four of God's names that we have in the Bible. And it's probably not new. Some of you have heard these before. But how he got them, the circumstances around when he got them, I find very interesting. It tells us some things about him that explain why we keep doing what we do. That explains how we are supposed to live. So the first one is Elohim. He is supreme. Obviously, this is Hebrew word, Elohim. It is actually a plural word, and it's kind of a generic word, too. It could be translated as gods, but when it's specifically talking about the God we know, it's in our English Bibles, it's usually capitalized because we know this is a term. Now, plural, obviously, the idea is the Trinity. They're not polytheism, okay? So we got the Trinity there. So what is it about the name Elohim that refers to God that makes us go on in our struggles? And here it is. Think about your body, the incredible body that you have. I mean, think if you took your finger and push it, like if you were taking it out and you push it against the table hard, would that hurt? It would hurt a little bit. Well, it depends on how hard you push it. I mean, you could break or whatever. But if I do that, I feel pressure, but it doesn't bother me. But what if I took a pin and put it in the end of my finger? Would that hurt? It would hurt. Why? What's the difference? Both has something. Yeah, I know one is entering the finger, which is kind of a different thing there. But how does my finger know that one feels sharp and one feels dull and hard? How does it know that? You know, we have this incredible networking of nerves and things in our bodies and our brain that explains all these. How did all this get put there? Okay, and don't say evolution because that's one of the dumbest things you ever come. Yeah, a creator put it there. Somebody who's smart. Okay, to keep it on a low level. Who's smart? You know, who's very wise, who's incredible, that could put all this together. And that is Elohim. In the very first verse in the Bible, Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God, that is the word Elohim, if you're reading it in the Hebrew, created the heaven and the earth. So the idea is, here's Elohim, the God who created all this. If he created everything, he must really be something. Because if he created, he understands it. How many of you understand? Do we have any scientists in here? Anyone like, you love science? Some nods? Okay. I think science is cool. I don't understand it. I tried to do some study on some things, and it's like, wow, this is just, it's amazing how everything fits together. Any of you are computer geeks? Computer people, okay? All right. Some computer people label themselves computer geeks or nerds, but you know a lot about computers. In my last life, I was a computer guy before I was in the ministry. That's what I actually went to undergrad school for. So I understood a few things about computers, but many people, when they sit down at a computer, it's a magic box. You turn it on. This is a story. I worked in the computer lab at my college. I went to Tennessee Temple back when it was. But I went to Tennessee Temple and I ran the computer lab for a while. And you know, on these old computers, they would lock them. They have this metal key. You could open the box. We gave some computers to somebody at one time. They were old ones. And this lady called me and said, I have the key and I have the box. How do I use the key to get the data out of the computer? And I said, well, one more time, I'm not quite getting what you want. To get the data out of the computer, you plug it in, you turn it on, you take the keyboard there. Some people don't know. And that might be some of you. You know, I don't have a clue, and now we got phones and iPads and all this stuff. But some of you, you turn it on, and there's some kind of witchcraft that happens in there, and boom, what I want appears on the screen. Okay, you don't have a clue. But you go to a computer person, and they could say, let me give you the technical end of it. You know, you can boil it all down to bytes, into bits, and series of pulses. It's all binary, just a series of pulses, and that's all it is. And then you extrapolate it out into what you see on the screen and what you print out. Most people don't get all that, because they don't have to. Right? But a computer guru will understand all that. And by the way, I love this. I found this tech support. You might not be able to read it. They're on the phone, right? Go to the preferences file, click on the pull down menu, find the option that says nothing works right, and uncheck it. You ever wish, you wish you had one of those on your computer? It's gotta be a nothing works right, and that's gotta be in Windows too. So anyway, a computer technician understands it. And when a computer technician speaks to the masses about how it works, everyone else sits there with a dazed look on their face, like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And you think that person is so smart because they know how this works. Well, we as people still have not figured out everything about how creation works. They're still trying to figure it out. After all these years of living on this earth, we're still trying to figure out how our bodies work. And it's just amazing. And people keep finding things out about science. And there's God who made it all. So if you have God who made it all, this really incredible stuff that we can't even begin to understand, isn't he worthy of us serving him? Whether we feel like it or not. So here's our question. Want to quit? Remember that you are working for the supreme ruler of the universe. That's what the name Elohim should tell us. Hey, you're working for the supreme ruler of the universe, so you don't just quit. Obviously, there's times you need to step back a little bit, you know, break. Or that's not what I'm talking about. But when you just walk out and you say, I am done with this. Wait a minute, you're working for God. Any of you remember President Nixon? If you don't remember him, you heard about him. To date myself, he was president when I was born. Okay, I was born in 73. Makes me 46, so stop counting. Okay, so President Nixon was president. So I don't remember any of this, but it really kind of intrigued me about what was happening. And so I started reading some of this, what happened. And I read Charles Colson's book. It's probably Born Again, probably that book. But one of the things he mentioned, you know, Charles Colson was one of the henchmen, one of the bad guys. He and G. Gordon Liddy, right? Did I get that right? They're the bad guys for President Nixon, carrying out a lot of his sinister plans. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he went to prison for it. Well, as he wrote about this, he said, people ask me, why would you do these things that you knew were wrong for the president? And he said this. He said, when you get out of the plane with the president, and everybody's gathered around and they're playing Hail to the Chief, you understand the power of that man and you will do anything for that man. And that's what sent him to prison, because he did that. And as, you know, you go and you do your work and you think, wait a minute, I'm not just doing this for the President of the United States. I'm doing this for the God who created our bodies. I'm doing this for the God who created this whole universe. That ought to mean something. So maybe I don't feel like it. But you know what? There's a reason to continue whether we feel like it or not, and that is that we serve Elohim, who created everything. Let's move to the next one. The next one. I would say most people have heard this name before. Jehovah? Yahweh? The personal name of God, the Father? Which simply means he exists. Okay, here's a story behind where we get this name. Now, what I'm going to talk about here is the name that it was officially given to the Israelites, but there were earlier times when the name was used, but this is the time when God really nailed it down and said, hey, this is my name and I want you to understand it. This happens, of course, when the Israelites were in forced bondage in Egypt. They were in Egypt through a whole series of circumstances, and Moses, of course, was there, and Moses, he has this altercation with this guy who's beating up one of his fellow Israelites. And so he kills the Egyptian and he gets on top of Egypt's most wanted. And so he flees out to the wilderness, finds this girl to marry, starts working for her dad. Now to me, that's not happening. Okay. But he's working for daddy-in-law here out in the field, out in the wilderness, and he's watching dad's sheep, his father-in-law's sheep. And so, as you know, the story, he's out walking around one day and and just kind of enjoying life, chilling, you know, no stress out there, watching these sheep, got a wife, yeah, everything's good. And he sees this bush that's on fire. And he approaches the bush, and the bush starts talking to him, which is kind of freaky, you know. And so he stopped. I think there's a lot of things that aren't written there about, you know, Moses, how freaked he would have been. And eventually, you know, this bush, the voice says, take off your shoes, you're on holy ground. What would you do if that, if a burning bush said that to you? Your shoes will be off whether you took them off or you left so fast that you left them there. Okay. So you're right. So this is really quite a circumstance. And so out of this bush, God is speaking to Moses and he's saying, Moses, this is what I want you to do. My people are slaves in Egypt and I want them to be set free. So your job is to go back to Egypt, tell Pharaoh, the king, the one who has the ability to lop off your head without a second thought. No one's going to question him. Go back to him, the guy that knows that you are wanted for murder of one of his people, and tell him to let all the slaves go. And Moses says, well, that sounds like a great job for somebody else. Let somebody else do it. And, you know, you've heard that whole back and forth between God and Moses. I don't want to do it. You'll do it. I don't want to do it. You'll do it. Finally, Moses said, somebody else will do it. And God says, no. That's when God got mad. No, you're going to do it. And if you won't run your mouth and do it, bring Aaron, but you're going to go do it. And so Moses starts coming up with all these excuses. I can't talk very well. And God says, like that's a surprise to me. Now, this is not verbatim, okay? I made your mouth. I kind of know what you can and can't do. It doesn't matter how skilled you are. You're going to go and do it anyway. But then he says, God, there's another reason you probably haven't thought of, besides the fact that they want to kill me for what I did. The problem I have is that the Israelites themselves aren't going to listen to me. I'm reading between the lines, but I can imagine this happening. Moses saying to God, he's talking to this bush, okay, and God's speaking out of the bush. He says, God, there's something you must have forgot here. The Israelites have been living in Egypt for hundreds of years as slaves, and it's got really hard for them. They know that they have a God named Elohim. For all these hundreds of years, though, where has Elohim been? Obviously, Elohim doesn't care about them anymore because he's left them, right? And so Moses is saying, I have to go back. Not only do I have to deal with Pharaoh, but I got to go talk to the Israelites and say, oh, by the way, Elohim, who's left you out here as slaves, wants to bring you out here into the wilderness. What are they going to say? Yeah, you're kidding? We're not going to follow Elohim. He doesn't care about us. Can you see what's going on here? And so Moses says to God, God, I can't go back and do this. Not only will Pharaoh not listen to me, but the people of Israel aren't going to listen to me. If I go back and tell them Elohim wants you to listen to me, they're going to say, we don't care about Elohim because he doesn't care about us. In fact, we know all about Elohim, but we don't even think that he exists. Because if Elohim existed, he would not leave us, children of Abraham, as slaves for hundreds of years. This is Moses' reasoning. This is his thinking here. So he said this, you know, there is no way. So let me read this to you. I think I have this on your outline for you. Exodus 3. And Moses said unto God, behold, when I come to the children of Israel and shall say unto them, the God of your fathers hath sent me unto you, and they shall say to me, what is his name? It's like, okay, is this Elohim? If so, we're not interested. So what's his name? What do I say to them? And God said unto Moses, here's the name, I am that I am. And he said, thus shall you say to the children of Israel, I am, hath sent me to you. Now, grammatically, that's kind of weird, right? What's your name? I am. What does that mean? Well, in Hebrew, it's the word hayah, which is the root word for the name Yahweh, Jehovah. That's what Jehovah means. I am. Exist. I just am. What's your name? I am. So in other words, what God is telling Moses to do is, Moses, you go and tell these people who think I don't even exist, and if I do, I sure don't care about them. Tell them, when they say, okay, tell me the name of this God, say, his name is, I exist. He's telling them, let these people know that I actually am alive. Not only that I'm alive, but I care about them. He's reminding them that he truly exists. Do you ever feel like you're in Egypt? We went to Florida our first stint in the ministry, assistant pastor in Florida. If I'd known what was going to happen, I probably never would have gone. We were there for 13 months and went through all kinds of turmoil. Before we left, somebody said, Florida is Egypt. Anyone from Florida? Didn't I meet someone from Florida back here? You're from Florida, I think. Where we went, it was that church. It wasn't Florida, it was that church. It was like Egypt. I mean, I got 20 years of experience in 13 months there. It's just horrendous for us. And so I kind of understood what this is. Israel is in Egypt. They're going through all these troubles, okay? And so sometime you're in Egypt, you feel like you're out there. It's like God doesn't even care. I mean, is he even here? What's going on? That can be ministry sometime. Whether you're a full-time paid ministry person or you're working, you know, as a volunteer, sometime ministry can feel like slave labor for people who hate you. I didn't just say that out loud. That's only between us. Sometime it can feel like that. You know, I put all of my heart into these kids and their parents complain about everything I do. You know, I put my heart into these people and they backstab me. It happens from time. I don't want to discourage anybody that's thinking about ministry, but it's the reality of it. Because we have an enemy, right? Because we have an enemy that we're fighting. But regardless of all that, you are still working for the God who actually exists. If you stop and think about that for a minute, that should be some kind of encouragement to keep on. You're not just doing this because this is a social club. You're doing it because there's a God who, not just the God who made everything, Elohim, but the God who actually exists, Jehovah. So you want to quit? Remember, you're working for the God who actually exists. All right. Elohim, Jehovah. Let's go to the third one. There's a lot of names for God in the Bible. I just picked out four to talk about here today. All right, everyone keeping up with me so far? Anyone need to stand up and wake up? Sing a song? Okay, let's go to the next one. Elroy. Elroy. I don't know if this is where we get the English name Elroy or not. I have no idea, but you can think so if that's your name. Elroy, which means he sees. Now, I find this very interesting. If you never really thought about where this name of God comes from, obviously this is a Hebrew word. This happens in the time of Abraham. If you're familiar with the Old Testament, you might remember Abraham and Hagar, the situation there. God came to Abraham and said, Abraham, you're going to have a son. And Abraham says, okay, that's cool. He changed the name from Abram to Abraham. I like that. Abram to Abraham. Abram, it means like high father or something like that. And Abraham means father of multitude or something like that. And so he doesn't have any kids, okay? By the way, I'm a father of multitude. And how do you explain that to people? You know, I don't have any kids yet. So God says, Abraham, I'm going to give you a child. And Abraham says, that's cool. Well, years go by and it doesn't happen. And finally, he and his wife, Sarah, work up this plan where he's going to have a child through Sarah's maid, Hagar. So Hagar gets pregnant. And now Abraham thinks, I've got the child of promise here. And God says, no. When I ask you to do something, you don't do it the wrong way. When I tell you you're going to have a child, it's going to be with your wife, Sarah. And so obviously this problem here caused problem all the way down through today. So Hagar had this child. This caused a problem between Hagar and Sarah. Because Sarah is the mistress. Hagar is the slave, and now in that society, if you had children, it elevated you in society. If you did not have children, it demoted you in society. So here's Hagar, who is now socially elevated above her master, or mistress, I guess, of being a woman, Sarah. And so this caused problems. All of a sudden, Sarah's like, wait a minute here. My slave is socially superior to me now, and they had this little cat fight going on, or something like that. And so they come to bring this thing to Abraham. What do? Abraham says, well, tell Hagar and her son Ishmael to leave. Okay, so they have to go. So here's Hagar. She's kind of like, what? I'm a servant. I'm a slave here. Now I have all this going on. And now I'm kicked out in the wilderness. So Hagar's kicked out in the wilderness and she starts heading to home. She was an Egyptian. She starts heading home. Now you stop and think about Hagar for a minute. Hagar was an Egyptian who came to work for Abraham. And so Hagar, having grown up in Egypt, most likely would have been a polytheist, which means that she would have believed in many gods. That's what polytheism means, many gods. So, you know, that was a very polytheistic society. And so most likely she had grown up, you know, believing there's all kind of gods, the god of the sun and the god of the moon and the god of all this stuff. But then she goes to work for Abraham. And Abraham is a monotheist, which he believes there's one God. And so if you just kind of imagine what it would have been like for Hagar as she's going through life now trying to figure this out. At home when I was a kid, it was many gods. Now Abraham keeps talking about one God. Well, which one is it? So maybe you can kind of see the difficulty that she would be having in her life trying to figure some things out here. And so, and now here she is being banished out into the wilderness. And she doesn't have any gods, right? I mean, where were the gods of Egypt? Where was Abraham's God? I mean, do any gods exist? And if they do any of them care about me? So we're going to read this, and I think I gave you this too. If not, it's in Genesis chapter 16. And the angel of the Lord found her by a fountain of water in the wilderness, by the fountain in the way to Shur. So if you look on a map, she's most likely heading back to Egypt. Where else is she going to go? You know, nothing to stay for here in Canaan. I mean, she just got kicked out of her master's home, so she's going to go back home. And he said, Hagar, Sarai's maid, whence camest thou? And whither wilt thou go? And she said, I flee from the face of my mistress Sarai. That was what they called her before, Sarah. And the angel of the Lord said to her, return to thy mistress and submit thyself under her hands. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said to her, behold, thou art with child and shall bear a son. This is obviously before Ishmael was born, but she's pregnant. And shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction. And he, Ishmael, will be a wild man. His hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. So, God comes to Hagar, who's searching, trying to figure out, well, is there a real God? You know, is it Egypt's gods or the Abraham's God? You know, who's real? What's going on here? And so God comes to her and says, look, Hagar, you're going to have a child. It's going to be, you know, he's going to be a wild man. He's going to have many, many descendants. What he's telling her is like, Hagar, I know you're out here in the wilderness. You feel like you're going to die. You don't have anywhere to go, no family anymore, no master to go to. But your life isn't over. You're going to have your son that you're pregnant with. And I want you to know something. I've heard the cries that you're sending up to me. Most likely she's hollering out to every god that she could remember from her childhood. Let's try Abraham's god too, right? And just try to get into her mind and find out what she's thinking. So she's got all these gods. She's calling out to them. And who answers? Abraham's God. The one real God. The one who later we find out is Jehovah. The one that actually exists. And so she's crying out to all these gods. Here's this young, homeless, pregnant woman all by herself out in the wilderness. And she cries out and the real God heard her. And imagine the light that would go on in Hagar's mind as she realizes after calling to all these gods, one God answers her. And that's Abraham's monotheistic God. This is the one God who heard her, but not just heard her, cared about her and cared about what she was going through. And so in Hagar's mind, okay, I understand Abraham's God is Elohim, but that doesn't seem sufficient. Because Elohim is kind of a generic word, means gods. We capitalize it talking about, you know, the one God. But, and so Hagar's thinking, I need a better name for God, okay? Not just the fact that he's out there, yeah, he's the creator. But I want something that describes who he is and what he actually does. Remember Hagar's situation, all alone? She needed a God who actually could look at her and see her, not just a God who's, you know, way out there, that's the creator and kind of left everything to run by itself. And so she called out, God Elohim answered her. And so she gave God a name here. Genesis 16:13. And she called the name of the Lord that spake unto her, thou God seest me. If you're reading it in the Hebrew, she called the name of the Lord El Roy. El from, it's the beginning of Elohim. Okay, that's kind of the singular word, God, but not just God, but the God who sees me. For she said, have I also here looked after him that seeth me? So she's like, okay, here's this God, and obviously this is Abraham's God, and there's one God, and he sees me. He's the God, not just the God who is looking at me and laughing at my plight, but the God who does something about it. Several years ago, my youngest son is 9. And so several years ago, he was obviously a little bit, good bit younger. And I was down in the basement of our house that we lived in at the time. And I finished the basement, but it was later. At this time, the stairs were all wood, you know, kind of the rail along the side and concrete at the bottom. And I was downstairs doing something, and I heard this racket on the stairs. Clump, 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 clump. You know, when you have kids, that's a terrible sound. Clump, 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 followed by, wah! You've been there. Okay? And so I look up, and here's my little son. He's got a sippy cup or two, and his blanket, and an armload of toys, and he misnegotiated some of the steps. And by the time I got to him, he was about two-thirds of the way down the steps, hanging off the side like a monkey, with all this stuff, and a gash on his forehead, and he's crying. Okay, now I had a decision to make. I could stand here and look at my son and laugh. Oh, I bet that was a fun ride. By the way, a little side thing. When this one was young, he went out to the neighbor's house and had a swing set and had a platform on the swing set about this high. And he fell off it. And he was crying. So I went over there. Are you okay? And this is what he said. He said, it was fun on the way down. When you hit the bottom, it's not so fun. But here's my youngest son, Brayden. He's kind of hanging there, and he's got a, you know, blanket and sippy cup and toys and everything. And he's calling out for me, right? Just like Hagar's calling out for any God that would listen to her as she's out in the wilderness. And so what did I do to my son? I went over there. I gathered up all the toys, picked him up, and took care of him, right? And I was the hero because I helped my son who was in this awful, it's a little bit comical except him being hurt, you know, but I helped my son who's in this trouble. And that's kind of what Hagar is thinking here. I'm in this trouble. I'm going to die out here in the wilderness if something doesn't happen. I'm pregnant on top of it and nobody cares about me. I'm calling out to every God and one God answers her and it's the God Elohim, but she says, it's not to me just Elohim. Because that's just the God who created this earth. Like the deist, you know, he just made it and just left it go and doesn't care. But no, this is the God who sees me. El Roy. The God who sees me. But not just the God who sees me, but the God who does something about the predicament that he finds me in. And you know, when you stop and think about why do you keep up the ministry that you do? Why do you keep serving God? It's because you have a God who, by his character, knows what you're doing and sees what you're doing and does something about it. Not that he fixes every problem that you want. I mean, that would be nice, but it's just not how it works. But he's a God who knows you and who sees you. He's a God who intervenes in your life. So you want to quit? Here's our third reason to keep it up. Remember that you're working for the God who sees you and intervenes in your life. Stop and think about that for a little bit. So any of you got problems in your life? Issues in your life? Okay, she does. You got problems. You realize that God actually knows about this? You realize that God actually can intervene? And he does? Not always the way we want to. You know, it'd be so nice if he would just come to us and say, how would you like me to take care of your problems today? But it's just not how it goes. Yeah, fix it for me. Fix it this particular way too. That would be really nice. But it doesn't work that way, at least not in my life. But here's Hagar who is out there and, you know, is there a real God? And she has this problem. She calls out. The real God hears her. The real God doesn't just hear her, but he does something about it. He intervenes and he rescues her out of this trouble. So she says, you know what? Here's this God and I'm going to not just call him Elohim. I'm going to call him El Roy, the God who sees me. She also, I believe she put a well there and she named it Beer Lahai Ro. I don't have it written down, so I'm mixing it up. But it's called the well of the God who sees me. So they named everything, right? In the Old Testament, it seems like. So what if God would have talked to Hagar and said, Hagar, isn't that great English? I see the problem that you have. I know it's there. You need to figure a way out of that. Yeah. I don't think she would have named him Elroy, the God who sees. It wasn't such a big deal to her that God saw her predicament, but that God saw and did something about it. In this case, it worked out well for her. And again, not always, you know, he doesn't always work it out the way that we want him to work it out, but we have a God who can and who cares. That's the thing. Who cares. So, you want to quit? Remember, you're working for the God who sees you and intervenes in your life. Let's look at one more. And this is one that's a little more, you might not know this name very easily if you haven't studied the names of God. Maybe you can't even pronounce it. It's a little bit hard. It's Jehovah Tsidkenu. Has nothing to do with a little boat that you take down the river. Okay, but that's how you can remember it. Jehovah Tsidkenu. The Lord our righteousness. Okay, where did we get this name? A little bit of history. Any history buffs in here? No history buffs. Oh, you're history buffs. Okay. History is interesting. If you study history, it helps you understand the Bible a lot better. And so, in the year 722 BC, Assyria came in and destroyed the northern kingdom of Israel. After King Solomon died, the kingdom of Israel was split into two, northern kingdom, southern kingdom. The northern one is called Israel, the southern kingdom is called Judah. And so Assyria in 722 comes in and destroys the northern kingdom of Israel, puts some, you know, other people in there, and so they become the Samaritans, kind of half Jew, half not. They were kind of looked down by the Jews because they're half breeds or whatever and all that. Kind of like Americans, we're all mutts, right? You know, we got a little everything in us. The Jews, they don't like that. Because, you know, be a purebred Jew, right? And so you got these half Jew, half Gentile, and all this mixed up in there. And so they didn't like them. So that's the northern kingdom. In the southern kingdom, continued for a while longer until 586 BC, when the Babylonians came in, destroyed Judah, you know, the temple, all that, destroyed Jerusalem. And so about this time is there's a prophet that comes on the scene, and his name is Jeremiah. That's where we get the Old Testament book, Jeremiah. So God is, he comes and he gives a prophecy to the people in Judah about what's going on. Hey, the Babylonians are coming. They're going to destroy you. They're going to cart you off to Babylon. And as we know, it was a 70 year or so captivity. You know, and Daniel is in Babylon at this time. It's how that all works together. But God gives Jeremiah a message that he's supposed to share. And you think at this time that the message would be all gloom and doom. And a lot of it was. God's message to Jeremiah, to the people, is it's your sin that put you in this mess. Okay, if you guys would have listened to me, Assyria would not have come in and destroyed Israel. Babylon would not be coming in and destroying Judah. So it's your problem. It's your own fault. You sinned. And so I'm punishing you for that. But in the middle of all of this gloom, all of this, it's your fault and you're reaping the repercussions of your sin. He gives them a message that actually is a message of hope. And we have this here. It's in Jeremiah chapter 23. And what God is telling them is, yes, you're going to go into captivity, but one day you are going to come out of captivity. So that's the hope in this message of gloom and doom. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will raise up unto David a righteous branch. And a king shall reign and prosper and shall execute judgment and justice in the earth. In his days, Judah shall be saved and Israel shall dwell safety. Now, if you step back and look at the whole chronology of the Bible, you know, this hasn't completely happened yet because Israel hasn't been dwelling safely. So this prophecy is kind of happening over time. Obviously, it's a prophecy about Jesus. You know, he came, but he hasn't made peace there until he'll do that. You know, during the millennium. So it hasn't completely been fulfilled yet. But he said, Israel's going to dwell safety, and this is the name whereby he shall be called. This prince, this branch who's coming, this king who's going to come, we're going to call him by a certain name. And here's the name, the Lord our righteousness. Now, specifically, this is a prophecy of Jesus, okay? But seeing that Jesus is God, we can put it all in together, okay? So, he shall be called the Lord, our righteousness. In the Hebrew, Jehovah, remember that name, we talked about it, which means I exist, that he exists. But he adds the word Tzidkenu to it, which means righteousness. So you got to kind of follow the thought pattern here. Israel is being destroyed. The northern kingdom of Israel has been destroyed. The southern kingdom of Judah is being destroyed. They're all going into captivity, but they will come back from captivity, and one day they will live in peace. That's the millennium, still in the future. And how is it they're going to get from this sinful nature, the sinful nation that God had to punish, to a nation that's going to live in peace? How do they make that jump? Because they were in captivity because of their sin. What happens for allow God to be able to bless them? Because do they turn from sinful people to perfect people? I mean, do all of a sudden they have this great reformation and no longer are the Israelites sinful, but now all of a sudden they've cleaned themselves up and so God can bless them? I mean, what happens? What causes them to go from these sinful people to people that God is going to bless and give peace to? Well, that's where this comes in. This branch, this king is going to come, and his name is going to be the Lord, our righteousness. What he's saying here is that you as Israelites do not deserve this blessing that God is going to give you because of your sin. That's why you're going into punishment. But you are going to be made righteous by somebody else, by this king who's going to come. And obviously we know that that's Jesus. And so, and that's why he has a name, Jehovah, the God who exists, Tzidkenu, the Lord, our righteousness. The only way that God could accept his people, Israelites, and bless them again is for them to be made righteous. Well, the only way they could be made righteous is through this king, Jesus, who's going to come, that would make them righteous. Now, it doesn't take a theologian, a trained theologian, to understand how that applies to us today, not being Israelites, right? Some of you may be Jewish people, I don't know, but I'm not. So how does this apply to us who are Gentiles? Because this is a promise to the nation of Israel, right? Not necessarily the individual Jews, because they have to believe the same way anybody else. This is to the nation of Israel. So what is it of, how does it apply to us? We always have to be careful about taking Old Testament promises and prophecies and applying them to us, because they don't always specifically apply. But general ideas often can apply, and this one obviously can. Because how many of you guys are perfect? You know, if your spouse is in here, you just, you'd love to raise your hand, but she would rat you out, right? So none of us are perfect, right? But because of that imperfection, there's no way that God can bless us. Ultimately, you know, the ultimate blessing you're looking for is heaven, right? And for God to accept you. What gets us from the point of being imperfect and sinful and deserving of nothing but hell to the point of being able to be in the presence of God forever? Something has to happen, just like the Israelites, how they come from being a sinful nation that God is punishing to a nation that God will bless. How do we as people go from sinful to be able to be in the presence of God? Something has to happen in between there to make us worthy of that. Well, yeah, it's through Christ, right? Through the Lord. Through the same one that's going to make the nation of Israel righteous in the eyes of God as a nation, so he can bless them as a nation. And so, Romans 3:23, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. That's the problem that we have now. We're all short of the glory of God. We've all sinned. Therefore, we don't deserve to enter into the presence of God. We have a problem here. When I was a child, I always felt sorry for city slickers. You guys know what a city slicker is? I grew up in Michigan, like heaven on earth. Okay, I lived in West Virginia for a while. They call that almost heaven, West Virginia, but I think it's Michigan, except for the winter time. But we lived out in the country, and we would go out there, and we would do mud factories. Any of you ever have a mud factory? Mud factories are cool. We dug this hole in the backyard. We brought water, brought the hose, and we made mud. And so when we're done making mud, what do we look like? Mud. I mean, head to toe, we were filthy. And so mom comes out, There were six of us kids in the family. Mom comes out. Okay, time to come in for lunch. And here we all come. And I specifically remember this one time. Mom comes around the corner by the garage and looks at us, and we're filthy. You know, what does mom say? Strip down, you know, to a degree. Get the hose. You're not coming in the house like that. Your mom ever say that to you? Your wife ever say that? Not, you don't come in the house looking like that. You're going to get this place dirty, and I just mopped the floor, you know, for the 14th time today, and I don't want my house messed up. That happens, right? Well, what's the problem with you walking in the house dirty? She's got this clean spick and span house. The kids were all outside. For once, I get a chance to clean the house, and nobody's in here messing up. And now all you guys want to come in and mess up the house. It's not happening. Okay? You have a clean house, dirty people not allowed in the clean house. This was my childhood. Okay? So you can't go in. So what do? You have to clean yourself before you're allowed to go in the house, or you're going to go without lunch. Okay? Now, you can see where I'm going with this, right? Because here's God's clean house. It's the presence of God. Who among us deserves to go in and be in the presence of God? Nobody, because of our sin, just like Israel was in sin. We don't deserve it. So how do we get from being filthy and sinful to be able to be in the presence of God? What crosses, you know, and people got all kind of ideas, right? You know, be really good, go to church a lot, do your religious thing. You know, you guys know all those dumb answers. Because you can't be good enough. That's the problem here. We've sinned, come short of the glory of God. Now, I should have put a picture on here, but you all seen the tracks, you know, where you're trying to cross the gulf and you fall in or whatever, you know. No matter how much of a running start you get, you're going to fall in. You're not good enough to get there. Until we get to 2 Corinthians 5:21. Whoops, I hit the wrong thing there, real. For he hath made him to be sin for us. God has made Jesus to be sin for us, who knew no sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. So we have no righteousness. Jesus took our sins and swapped us. He took our sin. We get his righteousness. And so therefore, Jehovah Tsidkenu, the God, our righteousness, Jehovah, our righteousness, is the idea that he is our righteousness. We cannot deserve it, but he gives it to us even though we don't deserve it. And of course, that comes through faith. It comes through belief in Jesus. So we had sin. Jesus had righteousness. He took the sin and gave us his righteousness. Now, that's kind of a salvation message, which isn't the direction I'm really taking today, but that's what it is. How does it fit in with trying not to quit, right? And here's the answer. Want to quit? Remember that you are working for the God who made you righteous. So next time you show up and you say, I just don't feel like it. Stop and think about that for a minute. Wait a minute. This is the God who has made me righteous. This is God who made me worthy of heaven. Not that I'm able to do things that would make me worthy, but I'm serving the God who has given me the undeserved righteousness. So even if I don't feel like it, maybe I should go ahead and do it anyway. And hopefully the feelings will change. Hopefully the feelings, you know, will come along. But we don't do it for our feelings, right? Go back to what we talked about at the beginning. We do a lot of things that we don't feel like doing. We do the laundry. We do the diaper changing. You know, we eat right. Actually, we don't, but we should. We do all these things that we don't want to do. Because there's a more important reason why we do them than our feelings. So when the times come when you feel like, I just don't wanna, there's reasons why. And I've given you four names here that describe the reasons why, but, you know, obviously there are a lot of others. So there's reasons why you continue on.